Hello, registered readers. This is Ashley Vance bringing you episode 11 of Semi-Coherent Computing. We scored quite the coup with this episode. We have Jim Barksdale on the show. Jim doesn't grant a lot of interviews, but a few strings were pulled and we managed to get him on Semi-Coherent Computing. He's a legend in kind of a number of industries, really. He's probably best known to you guys as the former CEO of Netscape during their bubbly years and during the Microsoft antitrust trial. Jim also was the CIO at FedEx when he helped grow the company from a much smaller operation, kind of the underdog in the industry, to being the lead player. And he also started a wireless company that became AT&T Wireless, and he's gone on to do a number of other ventures. These days he's kind of dabbling back in the wireless industry again, looking at some of the spectrum that's going up for auction through Frontline. Jim's going to tell us all about that and some of his efforts to spread his money around and help out with literacy and all kinds of different things. Before we jump into that, I just want to apologize for taking so long to get a new episode up. Thanksgiving kind of slowed me down, and but now we're back into action. And also, I think I promised before that I would not plug my book again, but I'm going to do it anyway because it's the holiday season and it's a wonderful gift for you or the other geeks in your family and friends. It's called Geek Silicon Valley. You can find it on Amazon or probably your local bookstore, or go to theduckrabbit.com. For more information, there should be a link, I'm sure, somewhere on the show page here. And with that, let's talk to Jim. Well, thank you, Jim, very much for taking the time out today to join us.
My pleasure.
You know, I was hoping, I think I explained in my emails, I try to do a little bit of a history of computing element to all of these interviews. And I was wondering, I think people will be able to tell from your accent, you know, you're from the South, and I've put a little bit of information about your background on our website. But maybe I was hoping we could start off at your early days at IBM. If I'm not mistaken, your first job was really at IBM as a salesman.
Right. My first job out of college was a data processing salesman for IBM in Memphis, Tennessee in 1965.
And that's kind of where, I mean, that's where your first interest in technology started, or...
Right. I was introduced out of college and recruited and by this wonderful new company and their marvelous new products called computers. They were big as boxcars. They were different colors. It was a whole new world.
And I
covered banks and insurance companies in the Memphis area, and then was promoted up to Princeton, New Jersey, where I covered on a national basis the top 100 banks in America. Showing them the early days of computing, where they were doing their basic bank accounting systems, insurance accounting systems on data processing computing equipment.
So you were basically selling mainframe kind of systems then?
Absolutely.
Yep. Right. And then eventually you and, again, if I'm not mistaken, you and a few friends got together and decided you kind of go at it on your own.
Right. Some of my IBM friends lured me back from New Jersey to start a company that we started called Econocom, that bought and sold used IBM computers.
And this was back in Mississippi, or?
Oh, no, we sold them all over the country, but our offices were in Memphis.
Okay. And then, so how many years did you guys go at that?
Well, the company is actually still in business, but I was with them for, 3 or 4 years, and then I was hired to run the information systems division, it was called, of a large conglomerate there in Memphis that had 96 different companies as part of its corporate umbrella called Cook Industries, primarily in agricultural, chemical-related businesses.
And then eventually, I mean, that work led directly to your job at FedEx.
Right. I sold that division we incorporated of Cook, and Cook had fallen on hard times, and I took the 110 people that were there, and we, not wanting to lay them off, we put together a business plan, and I presented it to this new, young, darling company that was just getting started, but was extremely screwed up in its data processing operation called Federal Express there in Memphis. And they bought our little company, and I didn't go with it immediately. I ran the insurance division of Cook for a while, and they came back and offered me some stock in their new company. And I went over there and was their, what we now call, chief information officer for about 4 years. And then... and we built the great tracking system that now FedEx is famous for called Cosmos, and a lot of other systems that were leading edge. And then I was promoted Chief Operating Officer of Federal Express, the number two position. I did that for about 8 years. So I often tell people I was one of the few CIOs that were actually promoted. Most of them get shot sooner or later.
It was
an interesting time and a great business, and we started not only a company but a whole industry, the Air Express business. It was fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to talk a little bit about Cosmos, if you didn't mind. What year did you guys start that project?
When did we start it?
Yeah.
1977.
And like you said,
and the basic design that we laid down in 77, 78, and began implementing, first using IBM's Airline Control Program, ACP, the offshoot of PARS, for those who really want to go into history. The basic design that we laid down is still the principle, the design that they use today of how it's done. We've added many components and many different ways of doing it to keep up with a volume that has gone from, at that time, a few thousand packages a night to now millions and millions every night around the world.
So what was really different about the system at the time is just the scale, and nobody had, because when I was doing my research for this, I mean, it's heralded as kind of, you know, the largest IT system of its kind at the time.
Right. What was different about it? Well, nobody had in the transportation industry come up with a way to effectively track the movement of packages and shipments real time. We developed our own printing techniques for printing barcode on air bills. We developed with vendors a scanner that could scan them, a computer that would go in vans for the scanner, then slip into that would handle a courier's dispatches as well as his uploading of his scans. The ability for a database to handle that massive amount of data, because you were scanning each packages up to 12 times within a 24-hour period. The online systems to build out our customer service centers, which were sort of new things, and only the airlines had really done it prior to us. So we had to support them, and as well as integrating it with our flight operations, the actual logistics systems that move the specific aircraft every night, and point-to-point load and unload. And so nobody had ever integrated, to our knowledge, anything quite of that scale. Now, that was over a multi-year period, all these things coming together, and today it's, of course, expected in that industry, but at the time we saw it as a definite competitive advantage, and our competitors didn't actually start doing it for several years, and that gave us a head start. At the time, we were the smallest in the business, and today FedEx, I'm still on the board, so I can still say we are the largest in the Air Express business, not the largest parcel company. That would be UPS, but we're very close behind them. At the time we started, of course, they were a giant, and we were just a peanut. But we saw systems, information technology, and the information about a package as being just as important as the package. And we followed that vision from then to now, and have done many unprecedented things. But at one time, we were told we were the largest single-image IMS database in the world. Of course, by today's standards, that wouldn't probably be all that big. But back then, it was huge.
Right. And, you know, as you mentioned, I mean, FedEx comes to the top of the list, and Walmart and Dell, these are all companies that are often pointed to for having the most sophisticated IT systems,
right,
and using them as a competitive advantage. You, I think I mentioned in my email questions, are you familiar with Nick Carr's paper where he was talking about IT doesn't matter?
No, I'm not familiar with that. I saw that in your email, but I didn't catch the quote, obviously, so I couldn't comment. I don't understand what he meant by it. What did he mean by it?
Well, I guess part of his argument, you know, he's a pretty bright guy, so it's a bit complex, but I'll try to do it justice. I mean, he argues that we've reached a point now where technology has matured so much that it's kind of an even playing field, more or less, for the different companies, and that, you know, this idea that you can just spend a lot of money and gain a competitive advantage isn't as true as it used to be, especially because you do something and then, you know, a couple months later, there's new technology refresh of the chips or hardware and software, and it's just kind of this rat race that people shouldn't focus on as much. I was just kind of curious.
I think maybe in a way I understand his point, and obviously it's not as much in many industries today of a differentiator as it as it has been in the past, but I don't buy the argument that people just say we can throw all this money at it. We never had all the money. We didn't. We spent a large percentage of our revenue, but it wasn't, relatively speaking, compared to the budgets of our competitors, all that large. It was just effectively spent. And I would say you develop over a period of time a mentality from the chief executive then and now, Fred Smith, who understood the power of information, as well as a staff of people who understand it, that quite frankly can be a competitive advantage from time to time. But most of these systems, the large systems of today, of in certain industries, banking, finance, transportation, and so forth, might not be a competitive advantage. I would argue in nowadays there are costs of doing business in many industries, but there's still things you can do to differentiate yourself and carry a competitive advantage for some period of time. I can remember back then people, we had a large company in our industry bigger than us called Purolator. They came to visit us, and the board of directors kind of poo-pooed at our expenditures on tracking. They didn't do it at the time. They're not in business today, and we are. So.
Right.
I remember the Postal Service talking about it, and today FedEx moves an enormous amount of their daily traffic is from the U.S. Postal Service, which has greatly improved their service. And I would argue that's a big differentiator there is due to information systems that support the air logistics and ground transportation system. So obviously you can't just differentiate your product by throwing a lot of money at it. That's true of any, whether it's information technology or branding or marketing or anything else. You got to do it smartly. So if it's dumb money, it doesn't make a difference. It never has, never will. If it's smart money, I think you can certainly gain some competitive advantages for some short period of time, or maybe longer period of time, but nothing lasts forever. I would agree with that.
Yeah, it's just interesting. It seems like when times are going well, everyone points to, say, Dell as an example, and they say, well, they've got this super efficient model, and this is why they're clobbering HP and all their competitors. And then when times get bad, everyone gives Dell a hard time for only really having one lever to adjust, which is price, because that's what their whole model is predicated on. It's, you know, it's just funny. It seems people have this inclination to kind of glorify something to latch onto, and they pick the IT systems when things
are good. Well, everybody is well informed of what their competitors do. I mean, there is no tactic that lasts forever in warfare and football or in business. That's not a great observation, in my opinion.
Right.
And no strategy lasts beyond the point at which you meet the enemy. So, but that certainly doesn't argue you shouldn't try for tactical advantages. What it should argue is that you should always be willing to change and cannibalize and move and modify. And none of us are perfect at that, and no company can be. I'm reminded of the great Collins book on companies built to last. If you look at the companies that they model, and there are some of them, let's not name names, are no longer lasting. They were big at the time. Or Tom Peters, back when he wrote his business books. It's a dangerous business picking any business or any football team or any strategy and trying to make an argument that it lasts forever. They don't.
So what made you want to change personally to go from something like FedEx into your next venture, which was a wireless startup?
Well, I was hired away. I was recruited, and it looked like an interesting new business, and it looked like an opportunity to get out and lead in a way that I hadn't had an opportunity before. And so I went out to Seattle and with Craig McCaw and his wonderful folks, and we built McCaw Cellular, which around the country was known as Cellular One in most markets, into the largest cellular company in the world. And then sold that to AT&T in 94. And it became AT&T Wireless.
I mean, you guys were pretty ahead of your time making the bet you did. I read, if this is accurate, that, I mean, you guys borrowed something on the order of $5 billion to get the operation off the ground.
We, let's say, were highly leveraged, is the nice way of saying that. We took a lot of risk. Craig is a great, I would say, a brilliant risk taker. So I'd had the pleasure then of working for two of America's great entrepreneurs, Fred Smith and Craig McCaw.
And then the
both of whom take bigger risks than most people would take.
And I mean, did you have a, you know, a genuine interest in wireless technology, or you wanted more a new challenge and the opportunity to run the business?
Well, I obviously wanted, if I was attracted, I was recruited, and, you know, by a headhunter and where these things go, but I don't think I would have gone to go run some business that I wasn't interested in. It was in a field that was new and exciting, a chance to build another, you know, sort of from the scratch business in a new field. And that was a very exciting to me. I can't imagine doing that for any kind of business, but I felt like that if I had any skill as a manager, it was probably in the area of managing people who managed system solutions to large business problems, and certainly a large cellular system network is a big league systems solution.
Was it, and you were recruited again when you moved to Netscape, if I'm correct, you were kind of waiting for the AT&T acquisition, everything to clear out, and was it Jim Clark and John Doerr that came to you, or was it one or the other?
Both of them. I'd been called by a recruiter, a good friend of mine now, David Byrne. We had at that time sold McCall to AT&T, and I was actually thinking about retiring, and they called, and these two guys who I had didn't know. I had actually read an article about this marvelous new startup of a couple of months prior called Mosaic Communications. So when they called, I'd at least heard of the company. It was like a dozen people. Sounded like a great idea. But it was Jim and John that came to see me in Seattle.
And then again, I mean,
very persuasive.
So that was your first time you'd really kind of interacted with, I mean, John Doerr, you know, people think of him as one of the ultimate Silicon Valley characters, and Jim Clark, too, for that matter. It seemed like that was your first encounter with Silicon Valley.
Not really. I'd been on the board of a company down there, Bridge Communications, that was sold to 3Com. I'd been on a 3Com board for a number of years, since the early 80s.
Oh, okay. Okay.
In the Valley.
And then, so, I mean, you'd done FedEx.
And I'd been a big customer of everybody down there, one way or another, jobs, et cetera. So.
Right. I mean, so.
But I didn't live there. That's fair.
You know, you look at FedEx and then wireless, and so somebody comes to you with the idea of a browser company, and you found that intriguing, even though, again, I mean, it's a totally different kind of bit of technology that you're dealing with then.
Well, but it was a solution to a problem everybody had. We had used online systems, various forms of proprietary email systems, and it seemed to solve a problem that those of us who had grown up in the industry and who had spent millions of dollars on these systems could. It was pretty obvious to me, at least, they were really onto something with a convenient way to use the internet. And the ability to interconnect previously disparate systems. And that was a huge breakthrough. And it was obvious the first time I saw the browser. But I had been using, in a business and private life, online systems for a long, long time.
Keo, can you give us a flavor? Everyone thinks of an internet startup, especially during the dot-com boom, as, you know, these big spending, kind of freewheeling, people playing video games in the conference room kind of thing. You know, what was life like at Netscape during the early days?
Well, it was a sort of organized chaos. These were the most wonderful, brightest young people I had ever been around. I was sort of the old man of the group by far. You know, the common joke, I provided adult supervision. But we had some famous instances of people throwing chairs when they got frustrated, working 24/7 and having to send them home. We had one fellow who actually was living in his cubicle, didn't have a home. And we started a thing called Netscape Escape Day, where I forced everybody to leave the building one day a month. We'd lock them out. It was just it was an unprecedented work environment excitement that you see in a lot of startups. And I don't know that we were unique in that regard, but it was fun. And we had the greatest opportunity because we had a great new product that immediately caught the world by storm and was the fastest growing company in history. And I don't care how jaundiced you are, that's an exciting thing to be a part of. It just blew you away. And everybody was so proud of what they'd gotten done and their part in it. And it was stressful. It was hard work. It was demanding, but it was also a lot of fun for a lot of people that I hold very dear to this day.
You know, I think some people forget after all those wishy-washy ideas came out, but, I mean, that, you guys actually made a lot of money. Yeah.
We were the fastest-growing revenue company in history.
Right.
Yes. In 48 months from a standing start, we created an $8 billion company. Anybody who ever bought a share of our stock, if they held it until the last day we were in business, March of 99, made money. Nobody else can claim that.
It, you know, when you saw the IPO, it was... it was pretty phenomenal IPO. Did you start to? Did you think there was kind of there was a little too much hype, or did you think it was, you know, a justified interest in the company?
At the time, I remember being amazed by the stock price, and having been in business in public companies for a number of years, I felt uneasy about it. Would probably be the right word, because I couldn't make the numbers work. I even recently had Alan Greenspan ask me, why didn't the bankers get it? In other words, the bankers underpriced our shares. They won so poor or so badly. And so people who came at share price, if that's what you're talking about, from an analytical base, couldn't explain it, nor could I, nor could anybody else. But you go with what you go with. It actually had certainly many good things. It made people a lot of money, at least on paper. But it also had some bad things, because new hires were way behind the power curve on their strike price being much higher than those who had been there pre-IPO. It creates differences, dissensions. It's sort of like what Google's going through today, hiring guys in at, you know, $700 stock price.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that in a second.
But it's what Microsoft had gone through long before us, so we weren't unique. And other companies had all gone through it in the Valley and elsewhere in the world. It was just... quite frankly, it, after a while, got to be less of an issue with me personally, if that's what you're talking about. I can't speak for others. And it was, we were trying to, you know, do our work and grow the business on the normal kind of a basis of revenues exceeding expenses and growing it at whatever it was going to grow at. We had came up with some unique ways of budgeting and planning that I don't think others had tried before, because we were excited about the growth of the business and we didn't know how fast or how long it would grow.
And then, you know, listening to your interviews, I know you emphasized more the long-term business play of the server-side software as opposed to the
right.
desktop software. But at the same time, you've got this blockbuster IPO and this revenue increasing, and you know, and then along comes Microsoft. It finally learns about the internet and decides to... the browser wars begin. You know, I guess at what point in time did you guys, it's kind of a stupid question, I guess. I mean, you just saw this giant coming. It must have been, you know, a pretty daunting experience at the time.
Well, I think we knew they were coming when we started the business.
You knew it would
just
be Microsoft?
Out of time. Huh?
You knew it would be Microsoft?
For sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it was an obvious play on their part. If we were successful, it would attract the moth to the flame. If we weren't successful, they probably wouldn't have done much. So our success, but not just for Microsoft. We were a target for anybody who wanted to get in. And everybody and their brother said, my goodness, look at guys like Barksdale. That dummy's out there making all this money. We're smarter than him. Let's go do that. That's just what happens. That's competition. That's free market.
And then,
it's a good thing, but when you're there, it puts pressure on you.
And how much of a toll did the antitrust trial, you know, for some of the listeners, I mean, you were more or less, I know you stress as well that there were a lot of companies involved in the antitrust trial, and obviously you look at all Microsoft settlements since then, they've had to pay out a lot of money to different parties, but, you know, Netscape was kind of, the biggest light was on you guys, and you were more or less the star of a big chunk of the antitrust trial. Was that, you know, personally, you were there for hours giving testimony. I guess, did that take a toll on you personally, or it was just a matter of something that had to be done? And
I don't know if it took a toll on me. I know that we were, I was the lead-off witness, and I was amazed at how long they kept me on the stand and asking me a lot of very detailed sort of step-by-step plotting questions. I think it never occurred to me or the attorneys that represented me or that we would be there that long, if that's your question. So, and from that perspective, it was very tiring. And I remember feeling drained at the time, but I mean, you get over that. It was interesting. It was, we had a lot of attention focused on us. You never like that, regardless of what you're doing. You'd rather not be in the middle of so much heat.
Right.
But it was fascinating, and it proved to be worthwhile. We basically won the case 8-0, and so we were right. But it was tiring. Yeah.
But you know, what do you mean?
You know, we all worked hard at that time, and the problem you have when you're doing that, obviously, is you don't know what the questions are going to be. If you knew all the questions, it'd be a hell of a lot easier.
You know, what do you make of the remedy?
Like doing this interview, you know, I don't know what you're going to ask me next, so make it easy.
You know, what do you make of the remedy? Now, I know you argued at the time that you thought Microsoft would be more successful as a broken up company. Do you still think that today?
I do. I think that, you know, Microsoft had more of a run, if you talk about the value of the stock, for a little while after that, and then they've been pretty much static for 6 years or so. But that, I'm not here to worry about Microsoft's strategy. I'm not an expert on Microsoft. I'm a great admirer of Microsoft. I said that at the time, too. But I did think that their practices that had made them so successful as a young startup and growing company, that we all admired their aggressiveness and their sort of take no prisoners, which were successful and appropriate as a startup growing company, no longer are acceptable when you monopolize a segment of business. And that's what the antitrust laws say. Now, if you accept the antitrust laws of the United States, the Sherman Antitrust Act, that's the way to go. If you don't want to use those, then change the law. But I'm not sure what the remedy should have been. There are smarter people than me who can worry about that. I think that their strategy since then, they have not grown nearly as fast as they did before then. But maybe that was preordained too. I mean, they are the third largest company in the world, so let's not pick at them.
Right. Well, what about the state of the browser if we don't look at the state of Microsoft? You know, Microsoft does almost the bare minimum innovation these days with Internet Explorer, and then you have companies like Opera, and then Firefox is more of an open source kind of thing. So
Firefox uses the Mosaic kernel. That's the Netscape kernel.
Right, right. But I mean,
and they have hundreds, I don't know, they have 10%, 15% of the market, my last read. That's what are there now, over a billion Internet users? Most of them use browsers. I would say that's pretty big business.
Yeah, actually, for our readers, about 60% use Firefox. And that's out of more than 5 million people. But at the same time, I mean, are you satisfied with the level of innovation? Some people would argue that the browser is just not as exciting as people might have thought it would have gotten.
I don't know. If you use a lot of the add-ons that you can get with Firefox, it does an awful lot of pretty neat things. And, of course, you've had the enormous improvement and expansion of what's behind the browser with these marvelous new services and companies like Google and so forth. I think it's a pretty rich environment. Where the browser ends and Google begins is sort of a pretty bland line to a guy just sitting there trying to find something. I don't know how much more you could have done on the laptop or the desktop with the browser once it was developed as a technology, but there are many, many people who know a whole lot more about this than I do. I've kind of backed off of being involved in those things.
But, you know, when you look back at the
I'm able to do an awful lot with my Firefox browser with a lot of neat attachments and some worlds and some great databases. I don't sit around and say, dang, I wish they were doing this or that. And I can remember feeling that a few years ago. You know, why hadn't they done this or why hadn't they done that? But let the young people worry about that.
What do you think about the people who say, you know, if we look at the server-side stuff or you guys' portal play, you know, that Netscape kind of missed an opportunity to be a company like a Yahoo or even today a Google kind of company. Obviously, it was acquired and moved out of your hands to a degree. But, you know, do you think there was a missed opportunity there?
Well, of course there was, but that's always hindsight. The fact is we were a software company and people like Yahoo and Google were customers, and we had an early philosophy, perhaps wrong, that I believed in, that you don't compete with your customers. I've seen that backfire on companies. Now, we certainly could have tried to screw them and gone on and taken over their market, but I think you need to understand that, as I said, as a software company selling 48 months after it went public for $8 billion, that's pretty aggressive. We were only a five-year-old company. Not Google nor Yahoo were worth that at that age. So we had hoped, of course, that it would have gone on to be an even bigger share. And even today with AOL's problems, you have an awful lot more unique users than most of these companies. But, you know, I could certainly sit here and tell you 50 things we did wrong, if that's what you want to talk about.
Well, I just...
But I would offer anybody who's got all those answers today, write them down and come back to me in 10 years and let's talk about it then. This was 12 years ago.
Mike, you know, I am curious what you make of the way Google and Yahoo and Amazon are going with all the... Because you pioneered the software delivery over the internet, and you could argue kind of software as a service type of thing. And, you know,
right.
Especially someone who sits on Sun's board as well, it seems to me you've got some of the server makers doing utility computing style stuff, building these large data centers that other people can tap into. That's something Sun is taking a lead on. And then you look at, you know, a company like Amazon that's doing something similar by having shared storage for customers and hosting their web applications.
Sure.
You know, do you find it kind of interesting the way things are trending right now, or have a sense as to whether it's going to be Google and Yahoo and Amazon that dominate this, or whether a company like Sun or IBM or HP would be, you know, ultimately delivering these services to businesses?
Well, that is a huge question that there's no way nor no one who can get exactly the right answer in the future, but I would say there is certainly a coming together and a fusing, if you will, of the software companies with the hardware companies with the service companies going back and forth into each other's territories. They're trying to find new niches, new markets, new users, new uses. I think that today it is a much more blended universe out there, with the net being so pervasive, but I also believe it's just getting started. I mean, you mentioned Yahoo. Yahoo was the darling of everybody 4 years ago, and now it's having its own issues. You mentioned Amazon. Amazon had an up, a down, and now they're back up thanks to Jeff's great leadership. I think companies like Sun, Dell, IBM are finding their way, and then you've got the whole different world of the Oracles and the other, you know, enterprise software companies, a whole different market, but everybody eyeing each other. It is a wonderfully efficient competitive model that we built. And as the world's economy becomes more of a global economy, due in large part to the internet and the different purveyors of services and products in it, but also the internet and benefits from the globalization of markets and services, and it's a wonderfully symbiotic relationship. If I knew the answer to that question, you and I, or if you knew it, we'd be wealthy men 5 years from now. So go put your bets down and call me back, and let's see how you did.
Yeah, it's something as someone who covers all these server vendors.
There is no model, like we were talking about earlier, that will guarantee to stand all the tests and rigors of time particularly in a huge market opportunity like this. We have so many smart people pushing to unseat you. And I'm the world's biggest fan of the folks at Google. I just think that's amazing. But, you know, the final chapter hasn't been written. I think that these things, whoever's hot at the time seems invincible. And 2 weeks from now, they wrap the newspaper around the fish and throw it in the garbage can. I don't even understand where you want to go with this. I find it just to be exhilarating what's going on. And I, as a board member of Sun and a board member of Time Warner and a board member of FedEx, I can tell you all those companies work day and night trying to develop and implement strategies that take advantage of these markets. That's the great engine of free enterprise that we live in.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I only ask as someone who covers servers all the time, is that I look at a company like Google and I see them building their own hardware and then touching the customer directly. And this is kind of different than when we saw in the last build out with, you know, Sun in particular having such close relationship with the telcos and kind of being behind all their services. You know, now you see Google kind of doing it on its own, and I just wonder what becomes of it's like you said, it's, I mean, it's just speculation, but I wonder what
well, I think if, yeah, I think I understand where you're going. I come from an era when we didn't have servers, okay? We didn't know we were missing servers. Now we have them, and they're a bit passe as a technology. What's the big deal? I can remember when that was a hot item. I think utility computing, enormous data centers with millions literally of small independent processors work for companies like a Google who need that. But you still have large corporate centers, telecommunications, banking, finance, manufacturing, transportation, who need another type of computing, and no one solution fits all of those things. I do think that utility computing for medium-sized companies might be, and even larger companies, might be a wonderful trend of the future. And let's see how it plays out. It has a lot of logic behind it. There are very few places other than large internet providers, service providers, and that would even be some of the newest companies, Facebook or MySpace, YouTube. That kind of computing wasn't even needed 10 years ago, and now it's very avant-garde and very, very interesting, exciting. But I'll bet you 10 years from now, those things are done in an entirely different fashion.
Well, Jim, I think I've just got a few minutes with you, so I wanted to touch on two other topics real quick before we before we end. So, again, I don't know how much you can comment on this because of the bidding process that's going on, but you're involved with Frontline Wireless now, so
yes.
You've kind of gotten back into wireless. And so for people who don't know, I mean, basically Frontline is bidding on the 700 megahertz wireless spectrum.
Right, a part of it.
And I've seen... Well, you know, what can you talk about? What are your intentions? What's your interest there?
Well, we filed our what's called a short form yesterday with the FCC that says we want to bid on a particular block called the D-Delta block, which is shared in our particular case with public safety. That's how I got into this, public safety being a big issue down on the coast after the hurricane, and I was head of the governor's commission to rebuild the coast, and this was just one of the needs we had, and it was obvious to me that the way for public safety companies to be able to ever afford the kind of wireless service they need, they have to go in conjunction with commercial users and spread the and share the frequency. So that was the basic plan of Frontline, but I'm very proud of the people who worked so hard to put this together and convince the FCC to not only do this particular share spectrum thing with this other big needer, nationwide user, but also we pushed forward and got approved open uses on cellular services instead of the proprietary types that we're all used to, at least here in the United States, that were the domain of the big incumbents. And so now if you're smart and bright enough and can get the financing and want to go build a product that happens to use wireless as its backbone, companies like Frontline and others could be a great provider for you in the future and wouldn't require that you meet their standards as long as it's safe to use on the network. It's basically what happened to the old line to long-distance telephone companies of the world when the Internet came along and changed the world. I think the same thing's going to happen in the wireless arena, and we were a big part of that. We were also able to convince the FCC to allow us to wholesale the service rather than have to retail it. That allows a company to be able to sell services at a wholesale price to a new provider, whatever it is, hospital metering services or patient metering services as they move around the country, or other new services that can't spend as much money on the backbone, the carrier, as they are trying to because of the low return on the service that they can sell. Those are big moves forward, and I think Frontline has been right in the middle of it. Whether or not we're successful in winning this bid, now that's another case. We're up against some heavy hitters with a lot of money, but we're going to hang in there, and I hope we can we can be a big part. And companies like Google and others are seeing the same thing, and they're going to be a bidder on a, on another area of the spectrum called the C block, which is a 20 megahertz band. And I think that'll be good for users, new services, new products, and the ability for people to use open source development of wireless services as a new model for how you get in the wireless business. Right now, you don't have that.
Is it, I mean, is this primarily a business venture for you, or is it more what you were talking about as far as, you know, your public service work?
Well, it's both. I got into it from public service, but I'm not going to, this is not all altruism. I've also invested $40 million in it, so I hope to get my money back. You know, I mean, but I do think that it is, it has the added advantage of really coming up away with a way where fire police and other public safety people can get much better wireless services than they have to suffer with now. And it's a big part of the 9/11 tragedy.
And just because I'm running real short on time, but this is something I wanted to be sure to talk to you about. You know, can you talk to us just real quick about, or as much time as you can spare on, you've also put money behind a number of literacy projects in particular. I think you've put more money than just about anyone in history. So, I mean, obviously education is, I think I also saw somewhere where you said if you have money left over by the time you die, it was a miscalculation.
Right.
So that's something you're focused on is education and literacy and kind of, there were some technology elements to that as well.
Well, my passion and the thing that I've really spent most of my waking hours worrying about and trying to make better is that in order to break the cycle of poverty, whether you come at it from an altruistic basis or from a purely economic basis, the only way to do it is to improve reading scores at the very early years. A child's third grade reading scores are pretty much the best predictor we have of whether they're going to be a net contributor to society or a net drain. It's an amazing track after that, whether they're going to wind up in prison or whether they're going to wind up working for a new startup company. This is particularly true in my state of Mississippi, which on a per capita basis is the poorest state with the lowest literacy rate. So we work very hard to improve that, and we're making great progress with some new techniques that starting when a child is 3 years old up through the third grade. But it's a long slog. We've learned a lot, but we've got a lot more to learn before we can make it as scalable as I want, affordable and effective. But we think we're creating an irrefutable database on how to teach childhood literacy to children who may come from homes in poverty, who've never seen a book or a magazine, who have no tradition of that, and yet we've got to teach them. Who may go to schools that aren't high quality schools, we've still got to teach them. Who may come from parents who don't push as hard for them to be literate, and we're still got to teach them. So that's what I work on most of my time. There are some technology components, although I will tell you that what we've learned is that is not the solution. It is essential, but it is not sufficient. We do some really amazing stuff at the very early grades through new types of television and uses of that medium and highly researched programs to get into child care centers and Head Start centers and then work with them through kindergarten, first, second, third grade.
What do you make of Scott McNeely's, you know, he's pretty heavy behind the Kariki project, which I've written about. It's kind of an open source education idea.
We've done some work with them on that. In fact, we have published our Reading Universe, which is one of the best curriculum guides for early childhood literacy teaching that we've developed over the last 6 years. It uses that technique, and I think it's a terrific idea. Again, technology, the internet, new ways of exciting a child's imagination and teaching them, certainly in many cases technology can be a great help, but basically it gets down to very focused person-on-person working with a child with a gifted adult that is able to overcome some bad habits. But certainly that gifted adult can learn a lot from information available through online curriculums and training courses that you see more and more of, as well as homeschooling for children. Now, there's some great new products in that area that are online. So I think Scott's right on. I think Sun is to be commended for working on that, and we are a participant.
And what if somebody wants to check out what you guys are doing or help out? Is there something outside of, do you have to be in Mississippi to directly help? Or?
Well, we don't take money, so I don't ask anybody for money. But if people want to learn about it, they can go to the Barksdale Reading Institute on the web, Mississippi Reads, which talks a lot about it. You go down through that, and we talk all about our curriculum, our people, and how we do it, what we're doing. And a lot of people are finding it interesting and implementing some of our techniques in other states and places.
Great. Well,
but I want to get our model so locked down and perfected and irrefutable that it can be scaled up on a very big basis and will be a wonderful demonstration project for the world. I think we're onto something here.
Well, I'll be sure to put in links to.
But it's a hard slog. There isn't any slick little piece of software that solves this one.
No, I bet. Well, I'll be sure to put links in to the sites you mentioned. And Jim,
I want to
thank you so much for your time. I know you don't have to do this stuff anymore, and I really appreciate you giving.
You're welcome.